Well, hello. I'm John. This is Johnny.
Hey.
And we have joined you again for another episode of Talk About That, where about
that
and other things too. So, how you doing, Johnny?
I'm okay. I'm a little haggard.
Yeah. Kind of thing. We're supposed to record yesterday.
Yeah, I woke up. I had a headache. Yeah. I apologize.
You had to call it off.
Yes.
It was hard. It's a hard day for me. I was so looking forward to it.
Were you?
No.
No. Well, you've been hear it. That's what those back. If you hear background noises, this week is VBS week at church.
Yeah.
John has been brought out of retirement as game director, program director. What are you?
Recreation director. Yeah. It's a pretty big deal, Johnny. I'm
very interested. You get a bullhorn.
I do. I had to go track it down.
No whistle. Why do you need that? You got the siren.
Right. You know what I love to do in the bullhorn is it has that big, it's the siren. But what I'll do is I can make the noise with falsetto voice. And so I try to let the kids figure out which one's
which.
So
I need you to do.
And I'll turn it on. And I can almost match it. Yeah. Almost match it. It's pretty annoying. It's kind of like Jim Carrey. Like, you want to hear the most annoying noise in the world? Yeah. You know, it's very, very much.
That was an amazing impression of a bullhorn. It's like the bullhorn is here.
Well, I knew I couldn't do it too loud. I'd clip the microphone, so.
I don't know.
Yes, I did. So we have a new student pastor, Jason Payne, who's doing a great job. And so he literally started like less than a month ago, right a month ago.
So we don't say youth pastor anymore? Is youth pastor like a...
We can call him, but it's interchangeable.
Student pastor.
I mean,
it sounds more, I like it. It sounds more sophisticated, prestigious.
Well, you know, youth, Johnny, is a hard thing to gauge, but student, you know, there's a moment.
I guess everything the youth pastors do is when they say, like, my teens, when they call them teens.
Yeah.
Teens hate being called teens.
They do. They hate being called teens. They hate being called young people. You young people.
Let me tell you something, young people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to know what to call them.
So. Well, and when those words get used up, and then they, you know, even if they still have value, it's like we talk about, they kind of,
yeah.
You got to move on to a new word, and there's no real reason why.
Remember, they're all of our favorite things that we used. So the young people, we used to talk about guys who stand up who they were making this comparison right now, this metaphor or illustration.
Their pop culture references were like 30 years old.
It's like.
Let me tell you who Madonna is. Her name was Mary, okay? She was the original Madonna, the mother of Jesus. It ain't Beavis and Butthead.
It's Jesus and the Godhead.
It ain't Anthrax.
It's passing out tracks.
It ain't Guns N' Roses.
It's God and Moses.
That's a bad one.
Yeah.
It ain't Jesus Jones. Jesus Christ. And he
wants
for Jesus Jones.
I do.
Right here, right now, bro.
That was the only song I think he ever had that mattered.
He had two songs, but that was the one that people remember.
That was a great song, by the way.
Was good.
Yeah. Right. It was he. Yeah. Jesus Jones.
Jesus
no
Jones.
Way that's his real name.
I don't. He wasn't.
Like somewhere along the line.
He wasn't Hispanic. Can I just say that? He did not. He wasn't look like Jesus. It might have been Jesus Jones. He was like a white dude from Michigan who called himself Jesus.
Whatever happened.
I think it was like, it's like an inflammatory thing you could do back then. Like,
right.
Just call myself, that was like right around Marilyn Manson. It ain't Marilyn Manson. It's, I don't know. Gold Streets in a Mansion.
I knew it was there. It was right on the tip of my tongue.
Oh, my goodness.
We used to come up with these with our bandmates when we were back in the band with Finley and the guys. We'd go for hours. So funny.
So bad. But yeah, that's why I do that now with comedy because I just did a youth show for middle schoolers.
Yeah.
So I was like, I don't know what to do. You start, your show gets sillier. You have to be sillier.
Right.
So any fart joke, poop joke.
Because you have a smart show. You know
I don't want to say I have a smart show, but I have a show that some.
More cerebral, if you will.
No, but there's some jokes that are, when you say, well, I have a show that. It's more adult. It sounds like you're going to have dirty jokes, but it's not adult. It's just like, so my content is better understood by a grown-up.
Right.
But anyway, I was thinking about that. I was like, I'm just going to update all my references to like, what's up with Cardi B? Like, I have to like know who the new pop stars. I don't even know what Cardi B is. Cardi B, I just finished cardio, and I tell you what, I'm out of breath over here. Anybody?
I right? Seriously, am I right?
Seriously, I don't know what I am.
Yeah, I have decided long ago when I was even still.
Never to walk in anyone's shadow?
I decided long ago that...
is that a vacuum and the mower?
I think that's a lawnmower outside the window.
The vacuum is upstairs above us and the mower's outside.
Is it possible to have more noise happening? Listen, guys, this is real life. Johnny, we said...
Like a Cessna's going to fly over in a minute. Like a crop duster.
Someone's going to call a fire truck. Then woo! Anyway.
Oh, wow, there's that impression again. You're good, buddy.
Anywho, I decided long ago not to be that guy who tries to act like he's significantly younger. Yeah. Like, it's better just to be the age that you are.
When did you decide that?
So when I approached 30. Okay. When I approached 30.
Because remember, there was a time there were frosted
well, yeah,
tips
when I was like
hair,
22 or whatever, you know, you had kids who were like 18, 19 years old. You're kind of still there.
You had to be.
And I remember there was. For so long, because I'd always had a backwards hat. We'd be playing basketball all day long at camp.
Kids love backwards hat. It's so relatable.
Oh, they love that stuff. And I remember that, like, I would have other youth pastors and stuff, and or even kids who would always go, "Whoa, you're the youth pastor?" They always, "I thought you were just one of the older kids, the leaders." And then I don't know what happened, but there was one very distinct day that never happened again. Like, no one ever, like, somehow I just all of a sudden turned, look like I look old overnight. I don't know what happened.
Enough hair had fallen out.
See, the hair was still strong. The hair was still going strong. Because I've seen pictures, the early 30s, and I'm shocked.
You look tired, maybe? Extra tired one day. They were like, this guy's dealing.
Eyes.
This is either the most depressed teenager, or he is in charge of these teenagers. He is thinking about their souls day in, day out.
I would love, you know, so many kids have come out of the woodwork the last few weeks and send me emails and other stuff, and I would love to ask them. I can take a poll. When did you think that I no longer looked young? Like, I'd like to know
what it would be interesting. Yeah, let's do that. We could do that on Twitter. Here's the thing I was thinking the other day, too, is we're talking about camp games.
Yeah.
Because Roy was talking about it. I went over to Roy's in my – Pastor Roy, who's doing the VBS this week, sent in my small group, so we're at his house.
Yeah.
And I was asking what games they were playing because you're rec director. And he was like, well, there's the old throw the cup of water in the kid's face
That's
game.
That's his favorite, yeah.
And which is that came from a day that him and Andrew were stuck at camp. It was a rain day.
Yeah.
They're in the gym.
Yeah.
So you can't do any – all the games you had planned outside. So the kids are already bummed. You're like, it's going to be great. And you're like talking amongst yourselves. We've had this moment.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, what in the world are we going to do? And so
we used to just stand on a stage and vamp.
Yeah, we would make up, like, act out your best.
Superhuman.
We would do, like, talent show. Yeah. Act out a scene from your favorite movie.
Yeah.
If it's got to be PG.
Right.
That was the thing, is you do, people get up and do, like, American Pie or something.
And the talent show was always some kid who was triple jointed or whatever.
Right.
And gross everybody.
It's always a double jointed kid. Is triple jointed a thing?
I don't know. I just.
So you can flip his shoulder out and then go back in. I don't understand
like
what a
transformer.
What would triple jointed be?
And he turns into an airplane. Or the kid who lets spit flow out of their mouth almost to the floor, then sucks all the way back up.
Oh, the spit yo-yo kid. That's a classic.
Oh, God, it's so gross.
But anyway, so Andrew came up with this game. They just had like a bucket of water and cups. That was all they had. So he's like, all right, each team, red team, blue team. And they sat one kid at the end on a chair. And then they all lined up 80 yards away in the gym. And they just took off running, grabbed a cup of water, and threw it in that kid's face. Then went back and tagged the next kid until they got through. So by the end, that kid's just drenched and he's been assaulted.
Well,
he's been waterboarded, in essence. He's been – it's wrong. It's against the Geneva Convention.
Well, you know, the key to that, if I was going to do that, if I was down to that place, you know, you could just tighten that stand there, John.
It won't tighten anymore.
Oh, okay. The key to that would be to put a leader. Put a leader in the chair. Because kids to throw water.
Right. It's like
a
dunking
leader.
Booth.
Yeah.
You never put like – well, that's the comedy principle, too. You punch down. Oh, wait, you punch up. Wait, you can't punch down.
Johnny, did you do comedy?
I don't understand comedy, guys. If you punch down, it's bad. So if, like, you get up there and you're, like, a good-looking dude and you're picking on ugly people. If you're a skinny dude, you can't do fat jokes.
Right.
If you're a fat guy, you can do fat jokes, but only about people who are as fat as you.
Do you
like, if you go down, if you go, like, that's all this lady, she was 400 pounds. It's like, you're punching down.
Right.
So it's weird.
Even though she weighed more.
She did. She weighed more, technically, on the scales, as it were. I'm still... punching down because she has weighted down her end of the seesaw.
No,
but
we did make up quite a few games this week. Like, for example, you just look in your bucket and see what you have. And we had plungers. You know, And so Jason and I came up with like plunger all kinds
on,
of games.
Plunger on the head?
Well, yeah. Like one is you had to balance a plunger on your head. And the little kids, by the way, girls, we would discover girls that had like pigtails or buns, that's really a problem. Like it doesn't stick to their, it won't yeah, stay.
There's no suction.
So then you got to, well, leaders, you can help them. But,
will
you
a
know,
plunger stick to head no, 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 with
not
hair
stick,
on it?
But you can balance it. You can balance oh. it. So they're running, you
depending
know.
Depending on how high their
right.
whatever is.
Right. So if they have something on their head. And then like Jason had a great idea, you would take a balloon and they have to balance the balloon in the air with the plunger as they walk around a certain thing. So we just made like five different plunger games, and the plunger, and then you tell the kids that we got the plungers.
Are these clean plungers?
Well, you tell the kids that you got them out of the bathroom. And then, no. I mean, the thing in the old
make
days,
make it a little damp.
Although there was one plunger that we only had three, we needed four, and Pastor Roy came up with another plunger, and he literally wasn't sure where it came from, so he bleached it all over. But we figured out later.
Long story short, all your kids have E. coli.
We figured out that it was from his game room. He saw a mark on it or something where he had marked it. So he had stirred paint with it or something. So
okay,
here's hoping that was brown paint. Anyway,
yeah.
No, the truth was they were all clean plungers. But the kids these days, when I was young,
yeah.
they would tell us gross stuff, and we thought that made it great. Like, you remember when we used to sit around the camp pool? And I remember there was literally one year I was pretty young that the guy told us all. He wouldn't let us jump in. And he said, listen, guys, I want you to raise your hand if you've ever peed in this pool. And nobody would raise their hand. He goes, oh, guys, listen, I have a friend that works down at the FBI.
Oh, right.
And he has a way. When you signed up, I don't know how he convinced us, but he had a way of convincing us. We were like eight.
Right.
That FBI guy could figure out via testing the water which one of us had peed in the pool. So I now want you to be honest and raise your hand. And, dude, kids everywhere, hands started going up.
Yeah, yeah.
He was like, all right, thank you for your honesty. You know, y'all jump in. And all the kids then, after finding out we'd all peed in the pool, just all jumped right in.
Right.
Like it was nothing. But nowadays, you tell a kid that the plunger may have been used in the bathroom. There's such a germophobic thing going on.
Yeah.
Like, their faces, they were literally disturbed. They were disturbed by it. So I had to tell them, I'm just kidding, guys. The plungers are clean. Plungers
what kind
are
of
clean.
Sanitized kids.
I want my kid to want to stick her hand in the toilet, Johnny,
thank
like
you.
We did when we were kids.
Yeah.
Childhood.
It's a rite of passage.
Yeah.
You pass something, and then you grab it. And then you pass it to the next kid. It's a contest.
It's a different kind of relay.
It is. Really. It's a weird. This isn't the baton. No, you're right. But I think I read that, though, that if you dip your kids in Purell their whole life, that they're more likely to get sick because we need certain germs. But having said that, you're a big Purell guy, aren't you? Doesn't Sadie, like, avoid things?
She does.
You overparent, right? You're protective?
You know what? I don't think we overparent. I think some of it has come naturally from her. We're almost like, go play in the dirt. You know, like, you're trying to – and she does. She plays in the dirt like she planted things this week on her own. So she does that. But then you never know when she's going to be kind of germaphobed on things. So she's not a germaphobe.
But if she found a worm while playing in the dirt, would she be grossed out?
She'll pick up a worm.
She'll pick up a worm.
She'll pick up a worm. I'm trying to think of what she wouldn't pick up. But there are – I don't know. Like, but there are things that if we're near the table – like that's the thing.
Yeah.
She knows to wash your hands good for then. So, like, if a piece of food falls on the floor, you know, it depends on what it is. Is it a chicken nugget?
Right.
If it's got a crispy outside, how long has it been there?
Right.
I thought the other day I dropped a Pringle on the floor, and this may go into my my next book.
There's less surface area because of the curved edges.
The less surface area, as long as it fell the right way, only the edges have barely touched.
If it's a Ritz where it's flat,
then you're probably going to throw it away. But a Pringle, you know what? Why not?
Do you blow on it? What do you do? What's your process?
Well, if you blow on it, you might blow off all the cool cheddar cheese or whatever. You just make a decision. How clean is the floor, number one? How long has the Pringle been on there?
I have dogs. That's not a good thing in my house.
Yeah, I have a dog.
There's some hair.
Yeah,
your dog doesn't shed. My dog's...
No, he
doesn't. It's a constant just whirlwind of fur.
My dog kept me up all night last night, by the way, again. Sick.
Broody.
Yeah.
He's winding it down, right?
I don't know. Well, Laura was out of town for travel this week, and I think he's
grieving, maybe?
So he goes on hunger strikes all the time.
Yeah.
And I think it finally just hits him, you know? So I took him out, and
what's his political stance, this hunger strike?
What kind of change he's trying to effect in the world? But without a voice, it's
does he
really
raise one
hard
paw
to
and
know.
Bark out, fight the power? What happens?
I don't know, man. I just, you can literally lead my daughter, my dog, not my daughter. Wow. Jeez. pets, children, up all night. Anyway.
You've got to parent them the same. It doesn't matter.
You just, do. You put them outside, let them go potty.
The HOA is upset, but whatever.
My friend's a little boy. That really is how it is. Well, yeah, he went in the yard again. It's like,
man, it's interesting.
He's a daughter. They don't do that.
Yeah, you raise boys different, don't you?
You do.
There's a lot more. Yeah. Just.
My daughter, by the way, she may not be a germaphobe, but she is. She loves to, like, wrestle right now and fight. But she doesn't know that punching you as hard as she can in your spinal cord hurts. Just walk up and just hit you right in the spine.
Well, because for a long time it didn't, and now it's like she's starting to get a little strength behind it.
Well, she turns double digits next week, or 2 weeks. Yeah. And so you're like,
she's serving at volleyball. She's getting a little, muscle tone. Something's
but you
happening.
Don't. But you see, there's a shame as a dad, though. Like you can't say, "Ow."
Right.
But you're trying to be like, "Hey, that actually hurt." You know, when you punch me in the kidney as hard as you could.
You say, "Let me show you punch her back."
Is well, you not? Can't punch her back. That's the thing. With you,
this
I can't,
is why I don't have kids.
I can't like she's it's my better. She's my daughter. I can't roughhouse with her past a certain point. So like I still when we wrestle, sometimes she'll make me wrestle. And she'll get mad when I let her win, but she can't win. You know, like I have to let her win if she's going to win.
Yeah.
But then she's mad if she doesn't win. So it's like, you know, there's this.
I think you're getting a little cocky. You think she can't, she could not win.
A nine-year-old girl.
Her finishing maneuver, like we don't know what it is yet. It would be called something like the Sadie Stomper.
If Sadie were to stomp like on my crotch, she might win.
She might win.
There's only one.
Fall.
There's only, but like strength wise, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, she's not listening to this right now. She just discovered the key to victory. But when you do it, it's like, but the same thing is she's still a little girl. So like if I'm a little too rough, it'll hurt her, you know, so I can't.
But you think, so if you think if you had boys, you'd be roughhousing by now. There'd be a lot more going on.
I think so. And we are roughhousing.
You'd be putting a 9-year-old boy in the figure four leg lock.
Oh, absolutely.
And being like, see if you can reverse this.
Right. Right. And that the boy, there's a rite of passage to where someday he actually does beat you and you're both worried about getting hurt for real.
Yeah.
But with a girl, I can't bring myself to like anything that would hurt her. Like we do this thing where she stands with her arms raised and I come in underneath her arms and flip her up almost. And she's like, and she's now on my shoulder, like totally with her legs, like Superman pose. And then I flip her back down. So we were doing it upstairs during the rec, during the games and messing around. Well, then I started flipping her around, around and held her, and she started. So she was upside down, her back and her legs started to go where I felt her little back pop a little bit and it kind of hurt. And I grabbed her and pulled her back up and she was like, "That kind of hurt, Daddy." And it killed me.
Right.
Like it bothered me the rest of the day. In my mind, it's just a thing. It's
you
like,
broke your kid.
Yeah. Like protect your girl, especially.
But you were just playing.
I was.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I
can you do that with me? The whole flippy thing?
We can try it after the podcast.
That sounds really fun.
This would be a good time to video something.
We need to involve like a trampoline and a crane.
Johnny,
some
you
sort.
Might be a 2-man lift. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't mean that mean.
No, it's not.
But I don't. And it's not because of you. It's because I'm not strong. That's all it is.
It's
it's
very
just
because
I'm not strong.
That's very diplomatic.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I hope Broody's demands are met either way. So I watched, speaking of which, I watched this documentary.
About a dog and hunger
strike? No. Sort of. No. 6-part CNN thing on Patty Hearst. Do you know about Patty Hearst?
Is this related to the newspaper Hearst?
William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper magnate.
He owned like,
yeah, he was like a big, yeah.
Would you call him a newspaper?
No, he was a news. He was like a magnate. He owned a bunch of other businesses. I think that's like when you're big and wealthy and you have a. I don't know. Anyway. Anyway,
I got a lot of words in my head, but I'm really sleep deprived.
He owned a bunch of newspapers. Back then, that was like the thing.
Oh, yeah, that was the thing.
You could use the news for your benefit.
It was like, the height of yellow journalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So anyway, his granddaughter was living with one of her professors from Cal Berkeley at the time. She was like just become engaged with him. She was 19. He was 24, 25. It was borderline inappropriate relationship. It started when she was like 16. That's all.
What year is this?
This is 1974.
Oh, wow.
So it's the height of student activism. There's, you know, there had been the shooting on the university. I think, was it Kent State?
Yeah.
There's stuff going on. It's an unsettled time. Yeah. Vietnam, the whole deal. And so this organization called the SLA – which was basically the Symbionese Liberation Army, which was just basically a bunch of criminals, like 7 or 8 guys, a lot of women too. So they would be like these feminists, but they also believed in like military force. Like, we're going to have a revolution and the military force is going to be required of this. So we're going to – so they started doing these crimes. They killed a guy. They killed like a professor or a – not a professor. They killed a school superintendent who was talking about, we need more of a police presence in our schools because the kids aren't safe.
Yeah.
They thought that meant like, well, the police are going to be influencing. So they just like assassinated this guy.
Wow.
And then a few months later, they kidnapped Patty Hearst. And her name was on a list they found. Like, they're finding all these things, this documentary that people didn't know before. Like, her name was on this hit list of people who they should. And I guess she was on there because she was kind of this princess of this. She was an heiress, in essence, to William Randolph Hearst. Although she didn't seem like – she just lived in an apartment. It was in California, but I mean, it was the 70s, and she didn't look like she had a ton of money to me. Yeah. But anyway, she had access.
But she had a name.
Yeah, she had a name. Yep. So they knew it would make noise. So they kidnap her, and the story was – and you might not know any of the story at all, but you'll remember this part. She there's a big cheer. There's a big cheer for kidnapping.
That's
great. That's weird. It's a weird moment. But anyway, so they – the kidnapper, they have her for like 60 days, just like, depending on who you ask, she was, like, the kidnappers are talking in this documentary that I'm watching. It's the first time they've ever interviewed, like.
Were they in jail?
Well, they're out now, the ones who lived, because a bunch of them got killed.
Yeah.
In this big standoff with the police, but there's a couple that lived. And the guy who's talking now for the first time is saying, she was totally cordial with us, and they basically brainwashed her to hear her talk. To hear them talk, she was looking for something to get behind. So by the end of like 60 days, they decide they're out of money. They go rob a bank, and she's holding a gun.
Whoa.
She's in. So the famous photo of Patty Hearst is she's holding a machine gun while they rob a bank together. So now this whole thing of like, when will they return Patty Hearst? Is she going to be killed by them? Now she's sending these communiques.
She is them.
She's back, and she's part of it. And so that's where we get like Stockholm Syndrome. And we, you know, because she's out now. She was pardoned by the president for her crimes, which were numerous, because she convinced them that she was just a part of this thing to appease them, and it got in her mind and whatever. But there were many chances, like all along the documentary parts, there's all these chances where people say, like, I'll drive you home. Not the SLA people, but just like regular people were like, I recognize you. I'll take – she was like, get out of here. Like she rescued them one time. One guy was pinned down by the cops, and she started firing a machine gun over their heads so that the guy could get away.
Wow.
She could have just driven the car away.
Wow.
So it's fascinating, that whole thing. And so it kind of – that was the first part of the news media's fascination with Stockholm Syndrome, meaning you start to sympathize with your captors.
Right.
And you hear that Stockholm Syndrome reference all the time with like abusive relationships. It's coming up now with the whole Me Too movement of like – and if you're in an abusive relationship, you feel it's necessary to defend sometimes. There's like – it's almost like a cult-like mm-hmm. mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't go against them because he's your leader or whatever. It's like that whole thing. So I was fascinated by it, and I'm not through with it yet, but it's like part 4 of 6 that I'm on.
Is it on Netflix?
It's on CNN Go, which is like an app on Hulu or
that is fascinating.
App on Roku or whatever. But I didn't know you didn't know the story, and I didn't know all the story. And of course, she is discounting this guy's account of what's happening because she was saying, oh, they raped me, they tortured me, they brainwashed me. This guy's like, none of that happened. She was totally a dyed-in-the-wool communist, ready to be, you know, to join us.
Yeah, but how can you believe – this is so hard. How believable can the people who kidnap someone be?
Right.
You know, like –
well, she didn't. She wasn't. She refused to be interviewed for this. You know.
Yeah.
I guess she saw no upside in like telling her side of it anymore because she's told her side at different places in the media. I guess over the years, this happened when the year I was born. So I didn't know a lot about it. I just knew about Patty Hearst. She took on another name, Tanya, which was like they all had nicknames once you join, and her nickname was like she was naming herself after some Che Guevara. Bolivian revolutionary, somebody who stood beside him. So she was already like wearing the beret, holding the machine gun, and all these photos. Crazy.
Wow.
But it's just fascinating as like a sociological phenomenon of what happened. The kids loving it, by the way. They're cheering even now.
So speaking of the kids loving it. So we were recording this yesterday.
There's been a 24-hour gap.
There has been a gap. We stopped recording because the kids – so every day during VBS, Johnny, they did not do what they did yesterday. They went outside to play on the inflatables.
Right.
But yesterday, Pastor Roy decided to do their big, like, oh, here's who won, the points.
And 12,000. You know, the points don't matter at VBS.
Well, I hope kids aren't listening because I gave out points like you wouldn't believe.
That's
like,
how camp works.
It's like 80,000 points and woo!
Well, I thought of a game, too, that I remembered from camp that I remember really thinking was funny and awful, too, to do to kids is smearing the marshmallow cream on a kid's face. And then one kid stands back and throws Fruit Loops or Cheerios.
Yeah.
And how many Cheerios stuck to the face. That's how many points. And by the end of it, like the body heat from the kid would melt the cream. It'd be so shiny and glistening and dripping.
I mean, like in their eyes.
It was like they were melting. It's like a candle melting.
It didn't.
It's terrifying.
And the thing was, whether or not their expressions underneath reflected it, on the outside, it looked like they were being tortured. It did look like scream or something.
Michael Myers, it had that vibe to it of like, I'm throw Cheerios at me now, I'll be a serial killer tomorrow.
Serial killer.
And that's what happened. Listen, and I heard there was a little boy that came to camp one time, and they played that game with him. And today, we know him as Marilyn Manson. Remember that whole thing, that whole story?
There's everyone. How many?
It'd be funny. There needs to be a story like that where the kid just ended up being successful. You know what I'm saying?
And that kid.
They mocked him. They teased him. Steve Jobs.
Today, he has revolutionized many African countries with his giving.
Yeah. What happens normally. Chris Rock has a bit about that, about how we've gotten rid of bullying and we think it's a good thing.
Right.
But he's like, who's going to cure AIDS? Somebody that was bullied.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, bullying, there's something about bullying that makes you kind of go, I'm not saying all bullying's good, I'm saying conflict can create things.
Right. To be clear, everyone, we don't...
I'm saying Chris Rock thinks bullying is good. I don't necessarily agree. I think it's funny that he would say that.
We think bullying is horrible. But I think there's very...
Some things are called bullying that are not bullying.
I was
going
to say that. Okay. Yeah. There's certain things that when we were kids, it probably had some elements of bullying.
Right.
But like... The shaming and the isolating on social media to the point that your entire character, we didn't know that stuff.
No.
There might have been none of the old 80s movies and 90s movies, the note would get, you know, put on all the lockers or whatever. And that stuff, absolutely, when there are those moments of isolation. But I think that there were a lot of things that were just conflict in childhood that today.
The idea of like somebody makes fun of your shirt, you wear a shirt that looks dumb, and then your friends go, that's a dumb looking shirt. That's not bullying.
Right.
That's just like guys do that to each other just to be dumb.
I mean, you get put up in front of the whole school and they all point
right.
and laugh. Right.
So that's different.
There's these lines.
Like to put the bucket of blood on the rafters, that's one thing. To tip it over on the person, that's bullying.
Yeah.
Those kids deserved what happened.
Anti-bullying America, not a sponsor.
That's right.
Yeah.
Why don't you speak in schools more, John?
I don't know, man. Well, you were talking when we actually stopped yesterday.
Yeah.
We thought we'd go get something to eat and come back. So we went and ate a greasy burger at Culver's. And that was awesome.
My favorite thing was on the way you said, they have a salad.
They do have a great salad.
I said, he ordered a salad. I'm bunching him in the face.
Well, I didn't want to shame you. That was the thing.
That would have been bullying.
Exactly. You were excited about the burger. And
I ordered first. I really made it a point to order first because I wanted to set the tone that, John, a salad is not acceptable today.
You know what? And I followed suit. Now, I got off the snack pack menu.
Did you?
I did. So
that did not look like a snack.
It was a small fry.
Oh, okay.
So
but the burger was full size.
The burger was huge. It was
that was not a snack.
It was like
burger.
A mushroom Swiss, but it was good, though. It was good. They have the...
mushrooms or vegetables?
Well, they are. And they have the calories now posted up there.
Oh, you don't want to
see
that.
And so if you look at it, but they're in a range. It's like if you get just the burger, it's this. And if you get burger and fries, it's like this range is like, it could be 600 to like 1,300.
Yeah.
You're like, depending on what you put on it. I'm like...
Mayo. Hold the mayo, so which I don't like mayo anyway.
You were ordering off the nutritional range that was going up as high as like 1300.
I didn't look.
I ordered off the menu that the range went up like as high as like 950. So it's still almost an entire day's worth of calories, but I just made a more sensible, horrible decision. So
that's nice.
If you're going to make a horrible decision, make it more sensible.
So we come back from Culver's and now the VBS is over, but they're cleaning the building.
Cleaning.
So there's vacuuming.
We literally had lawnmowers.
There's worship music
kids.
Going on. I don't want to interrupt the person.
They're moving chairs right above us.
Yeah.
Like, I don't mean on the floor above us. I mean, like, right above us somehow.
You never want to go over to somebody and be like, hey, I know, I appreciate everything you're doing for the church. Can you shut off that worship music so we can film our dumb podcast?
Hey, could you quit vacuuming while we're,
yeah,
while we're doing nothing of value? So, yeah. And I did work hard this week there, Joni, and I feel bad, though, because our VBS volunteers may listen to the podcast and then right. wonder why I disappeared, and now they're going to know.
You went to Culver's. They told you.
I actually hid down in the passenger seat while we drove past them.
You did. You slunk down like you were in the witness protection program.
It's horrible.
Program, which reminds me, Patty Hearst.
Oh, wow. Johnny, you, really, see that segue? You segued us right.
No one would have ever known that, had I not called attention to it.
So you were talking about the fact that she became sympathetic to the plight of her captors.
She did. And
losing her own plight.
I watched the rest of it last night, and it's fascinating. She was... she got time in jail for the bank robbery, okay?
So she was kidnapped but still got put in jail.
Here's the thing. She went on, this went on for over 18 months where she was with the SLA. Mm. She committed numerous crimes. They started doing bombings. They put bombs under police cars. And they were so bad at it that most of these bombs did not kill anybody. Like, none of the bombs killed anybody, and most of the bombs didn't do much damage. They were really bad at making pipe bombs, evidently. This was the 70s. Maybe pipe bombs have come a long way. I don't know.
Right. Sure. You don't know. That's our official statement.
Yeah. But anyway, it's kind of a comedy of errors, like, watching them talk about these bombs and how they didn't work, or the documentary. But she was involved, literally planted one of them. So, I mean, that alone should be a huge sentence. But again, she was able to – her. So this is when F. Lee Bailey – I didn't know this. F. Lee Bailey was her lawyer, who went on to be like – by the time he represented OJ, he was on OJ's team. Hmm. So by then, he was already a legend. But back then, he was just coming into his own and was like the star. He was the Johnny Cochran of his day.
Yeah.
And so it was like – if you know you're guilty, get this guy. And they had enough money to get this great defense. But then they decided to let her testify, and meaning she could be cross-examined. And she just crumbled under cross-examination. Because she's saying, oh, they did all this. They tortured me. I was in a totally different state. But they had all these tapes of her saying, look, I love these people, and I'm with them. And all the... But she committed multiple
always
crimes.
Claim, she could always claim I was doing this out of fear for my life.
Right.
And I had to play that role.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what she did. She said once she kind of – they kind of did their job of deprogramming her, what they said,
yeah.
Which basically was her – to me, what happened was she sat in prison long enough. She was like, I'm only getting out of this if I turn my back on these people.
Right.
And just own up to – just go back to being an heiress. Wow. And that's what she did. Now, again, this is my opinion, depending on what you think about – I'm not saying that I don't believe that it's possible to have Stockholm Syndrome and all that, which Stockholm Syndrome, I did some research on. It's named after a bank robbery where the hostages started to feel sympathetic towards their, you know.
Was that John Q? Remember that movie?
Right.
Where Denzel Washington.
But there's never been a Stockholm Syndrome case where they committed crimes for that person. Hmm. Feeling sympathy for your abuser is not the same as, I will now hold a machine gun and spray all over this, you know, parking lot so you get away from the cops and then jump in the car with me and we take off. That's a crime.
Yeah.
So she could have just floored it and took off. So it's fascinating to watch. And then she got her sentence commuted by Jimmy Carter. So she was let out of jail after like 3 years, not even 3 years, 2 years. It was an 8-year sentence for this bank robbery. Then the other trials come up. She did turn state's evidence. They didn't want her to be cross-examined again. So these other guys took a deal for the second bank robbery, which somebody was killed in that bank robbery, and she was the getaway driver, meaning she could have faced murder charges. She got away with that. She didn't ever face charges because she turned state's evidence for immunity. And then Bill Clinton, on the last day of his presidency, pardoned her in the 90s.
I thought she was already...
No, I mean, he completely, like, wiped her record clean.
So she wasn't on probation.
So when you have your sentence commuted, right. You still are, like, a felon. You were a convicted felon.
So he wiped it clean.
He wiped it all clean. So literally, she has no record. And she can profit from her crimes.
Because she can talk about them.
She can talk about them now because she never did it. So if she wanted to write another book or profit from the book that she did write, she's allowed to now. It's fascinating.
Wow.
But all that to say, if she had never been kidnapped, she never would have done these things.
That's true.
So it is a sliding door thing of like they did come into her life. She did not plan to be kidnapped. What happened to her as a 19-year-old girl was she was very easily manipulated and she got pulled into this life, and she, whatever reason, she was attracted to this rebellious thing. They were, and they sold it to her. Or to, if you hear her side of it, they, you know, brainwashed her and raped her and whatever else. I just, after watching this documentary, I just couldn't believe that she had ever been abused. I thought that she was, she romanticized this life of it's us against them. And either way, she believed a lie, you know, she was either lied to in a systematic way,
yeah,
and it changed her behavior, or she believed a lie and bought it hook, line, and sinker and became this convert to this religion, in essence, of anti-government, anti-police. And it's okay to bomb people, even if innocent people die. Like, it's crazy that she would ever think that this is okay, but she just, her mind was warped in some way.
It's interesting. It's interesting you call it religion, too. I was listening to, I've been listening to a lot of old Switchfoot lately.
Yeah.
And the Nothing Is Sound record may be one of the best ever.
Yeah, it's underrated. It really is.
It really is. And I didn't like it in the beginning. As mm-hmm. I've gotten older and gone back, and Dane liked it a lot. And I've gone back and I realize, I think that I'm sure it was written back then, that the thematic sort of inspiration for that album is Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
There's so many lines in there, you know, everything is meaningless, but he's spinning those things off. But the reason I said that is that the line or the song about, is this the world you want? Is this the world you want? You're making it every day you're alive.
Right.
And he goes into the bridge and says, you know, what you say is your religion. What you do is your religion. Whom you love is your religion. And he just, all these many, many lines.
Yeah.
And I think it's so true because we can become anti-religious not realizing that by definition, the things that you hold dear, that you fight for, fight against, all those things, they define a belief system.
Yeah.
And that belief system, whether or not you ascribe deity to it or not, absolutely it is a mirror of religion. And then you could make the argument that the deity that you're ascribing power to is just yourself or the group of people that you are
right.
living by their belief systems, which is that, you know, you think about that when you were talking about the Stockholm syndrome and that idea of becoming sympathetic or becoming desensitized to something that's happening to you. I mean, that's an exact, I feel that in my life. I feel like how many times I find myself defending something that's killing me, you know, and I believe in this. I believe we live in a fallen world, but I have it pretty good in this fallen world compared to a lot of people. And we start that comparison train, and it's you know, what did you say yesterday? Comparison is the thief of joy.
Right. Yeah. I think that's Chesterton or C.S. Lewis.
But, yeah. And so, but when you do, you know, you look at your life and it's sometimes you forget that we're not okay.
Yeah.
You know, we're not okay here. But your reality, I think some of that is a God reflected feature, is that we can find ourselves okay in not okay situations. I think that's, we can find joy or
full
happiness.
Full life in an empty place.
Yep.
Yeah, but there's a thing of like being content, but also kind of being ill at ease and feeling like a foreigner.
Yeah.
That is built into this life. And it's built into people who aren't even believers, I find.
Yeah.
That feel out of place. And they feel, but yeah, now it's about like, what do we believe about ourselves? And yeah, you're right though. This onslaught of like bad news an overwhelming amount of information that we were never supposed to necessarily have. And I know, depending on what you believe about the sovereignty of God, well, God knew this was all going to happen and that there was going to be Facebook and there was going to be Twitter and every day we were going to look at it and it was going to make us sad and we didn't know why. But it is odd. It doesn't feel like we are wired to know everybody's business all the time and compare ourselves to it. We talked about this many times before, but it is fascinating. And I think it's causing people to start to believe wrong things about themselves. And I don't know.
Well, if you instinctively, so, you know, I think there's two defaults in our instinctive belief that are cultural in today's age. One is that I'm supposed to be happy.
Yeah.
You know, happiness is that pursuit. Somebody texted me about it yesterday and she said, a coworker asked me, am I happy? And I I've been hung up on the question the rest of the day. And so we talked about it. The number two thing is that we're supposed to understand everything. And I think that's what tortures us. It's that instinctive, and whether you're religious or not, I find it interesting that that is the epicenter of the biblical narrative. It's the beginning.
Yeah.
The beginning conversation in the garden between mankind and enemy of mankind is that God is holding something back from you, and you're supposed to understand it. And he understands it, but he knows that you can understand. See, that's the subtle thing. We always go, well, the devil, the serpent offered them sin. And they, no, I mean, let's really call it what it is. What he offered them, the real lie wasn't the apple or whatever that was. The real lie was you're supposed to be able to understand things like God because you know you're made in his image. You know that it is really a lie based upon God's goodness. You know he's already given you great things, but there's more. Mm-hmm. There's more that he's holding from you because he knows that if you knew this, you'd be like him. So he's acknowledging you're not like him, but that you should be. And that we haven't talked about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So it's like
– it's knowledge.
There's knowledge, and it's like we think of knowledge as this – wholesome pursuit that's pure.
Yeah.
But we can be undone by that sometimes where we just have no place in our life for mystery, no place in our life for things we can't understand, and no tolerance for things we can't understand.
Right.
And yeah, we're living in a generation for sure. My generation and the generation that came after us, they're fatigued from too much information, and yet it's not satiating this desire to just know more. It's almost like Tower of Babel. Like we'll just keep building. We'll keep building. And if we all just get together, we can do this.
And that inner default that causes them to believe that we could reach heaven.
Yeah.
That, and we're offended. We are offended by the idea that maybe we can't. So my wife and I had a little argument this morning before I came in, Joni.
I am shocked. What?
And it wasn't really an argument. There was a pair of headphones there that are obviously Sadie's. And so I was thinking about – she has two. So I was like, hey, what are these pink headphones for? Because I thought I'm going to add them into our podcast collection stuff for our guests and everything. They bring their own or whatever. But this was just – I'm just trying to have all the equipment in one place. And she goes, John, this is literally the third time that we've talked about the headphones. So they're from Sadie's school and all that, you know. She was really, really kind. I wasn't mad at her. I would say it if I was. I'm not just doing this for the podcast. I became enraged in myself with the idea, and I disputed her. I was like, there is no way that we've had this exact conversation three times. Now, I know my memory's bad, but there's no way I don't remember it at all.
Yeah.
So I think maybe you're exaggerating. Like, I mean, I went, and she just stayed very gentle with me because obviously I wasn't in my right mind. But
she played the audio back.
That's what I'm saying. And then what I'm frustrated with is there's no way to know if what you were saying is true or that we did it really happen three times. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, I don't want to accept the real possibility that we talked about it three times and I am so finite and so not able to keep up with life that perhaps I can't. It doesn't even make my memory banks. And that feeling of fallibility and how even on minor things, it's offensive to me.
Yeah.
It's offensive. I'm offended at myself and then the implications of what that could mean. That am I really teetering this much? Am I teetering this much on the edge of any given moment? My mind is so limited. It can't be trusted for even minor things. And if that's the case, much less great things or things that really matter in this life. And that, so I mean, obviously everybody probably doesn't dive bomb down that hole. And I wasn't,
over headphones,
I wasn't thinking of it.
But I know what you mean. Yeah. We're raising,
well, I'm saying the emotional reaction came because I think somewhere deep inside, if we could ever come out and say it, that's why you feel that way when you forget something. You know?
Yeah. We're being conditioned to, and I mean, not to bring the president into it, but I think he's just a product of who we are, meaning that defensiveness, to lash out, that he definitely has that quality.
Yeah.
If somebody attacks me, I come back at them 100 times harder. And there's a as much as we look at that and go, God, this guy, we all have this thing of we don't want to be wrong. Like, being wrong is the worst thing, rather than, you know, it's like appearing to be wrong. Like, being wrong is like, we know we're wrong sometimes. We all know it. We could say we're fallible, but this appearance of being fallible to another human being, it's starting to work its way out of our culture as far as something that's acceptable.
Right.
We want to fight to the bitter end. And it never works. It never, and we'd see it online. It never works out. You never say, well, I see your point. You've really made a difference.
Right.
And let's walk away. And it never works out. It's just who decides to get flustered and just let the other person have the last word.
Yeah. Who decides I'm not going to go any further because I could? No. And I think it comes down to, you know, Laura and I were talking yesterday. It comes down to, we have this term now called my truth.
Oh, right. Yeah. We talked about that yesterday.
Or was that me and you talking?
We were talking at lunch.
I can't even remember, Johnny. My mind is so funny.
Your truth.
Gosh. Like, but
living in my truth.
When there's such a thing as my truth, that, and I don't think we're saying like, we're not saying that's my perspective.
Yeah.
We're not saying that like that's my interpretation. We're literally saying that my perspective and my interpretation is a truth.
Yeah. Like, and your truth can also be a truth, even if it's opposite from my truth.
Right, indisputable. And you're like, oh, man. So, again, it goes back. It's the same conversation in the garden. It is, you are a creator of truth. That's what it's saying. You are on the same level as creator, not creation. And I hate it. If you're listening to this right now and you are suspect, you have suspicions of anything faith-based, then it's like, if I say the words creator, creation, you know, I can, because I've been cynical much of my life. There are times I'll hear a Christian say things and I will roll my eyes.
Right.
Like, just because whatever they're saying is not my version truth of Christianity. So
right.
I literally,
or your vernacular even, like if they use a word, you're like, oh, I wish you hadn't said it that way.
Oh, exactly. Oh, absolutely. And I let vernacular and I let language and I let dialect and I let lexicon and all these things determine whether or not that idea is something I will even be willing to process, which is by definition ignorance.
Yeah.
Like when I can't open my mind to conversation to hear because I have already prejudged, by the way, the definition of prejudice, I am now prejudging that because of the words you use or because of the way that you look or because of the background you are in. And I get that there's validity to some of that. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should be open to everything. But it's funny how sometimes we become so defensive of our own viewpoint that the only other viewpoints that would allow our viewpoint to be challenged, we completely cut off. It's like we're colorblind. And then we refuse to acknowledge that colorblindness is a thing. If you're colorblind and you refuse to say that colorblindness is even a thing, then it's double blindness. Now
right.
It's like, not only do you have it, you can't acknowledge that it exists. And
right.
So if someone tried to tell you, hey, there's these new lenses that would correct your colorblindness, you're like, colorblindness is not a thing. You literally can't hear the person.
Right. To say like, I can't see green, so there is no green.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, by that same token, I think a lot of people who grew up in church need to open their mind to the thought that their lens on things isn't necessarily always right either. In other words, like, we're coming up with this, you know, we've got the refugee crisis, we've got all this stuff happening, and we were raised to think a certain way about it, and now we've talked in the past about how nationalism has weaved its way in to Christian culture, and so that's a lens. Those are lenses that come in. And you view the world through them, and they become twisted up with, what we would call truth. And some of it's just like, man, you need to, you know, you're not seeing the whole palette. You're colorblind in a way, you know.
Absolutely. No, I think that, and I'll use this word lightly, but real truth should have a level of, if it's actually changing your life, you could call that even offensive. The things that have really changed me were things that were offensive to me in the beginning. But the great offense wasn't the truth itself. It was that you're saying, like you said, you're saying that I don't already have it.
Yeah.
You're saying that something is not right in me. But the essence of learning is to say there is something I do not know. The smartest, right. The wisest people are those who know the areas where they have wisdom yet to gain and the areas where they know they have none. You would be a fool to be on an airplane and someone is having a major medical, you know, issue, and because you watched Grey's Anatomy, you think you could create a trach out of a ballpoint pen. You know, like, you would have to know your limitations to go, I'm not really a doctor, and that wasn't really a medical education. Like, wisdom there is to know that you don't know. And I think that that's the wisdom the most that we have lost. And myself, this has been the great, I guess, revolution of my life, is to wake up and go, wow, there's a bunch of stuff that I really was confident in. Mm-hmm. That I'm not – it's like confidence has come by me losing confidence in a whole lot of things. And it causes – I'm trying to – and then every day trying to do it more and more to go, you know, that's all throughout – any, not just scripture of what we would think, but any sort of philosophical slant from all cultures would say the path to learning is a path of humility. The path to learning is a path, is what C.S. Lewis calls the Tao. He writes about in The Abolition of Man, about even across various religions, that there is this understanding and acknowledgement of morality based upon the fact that there is something higher than me. I'm right. not supposed to create it. I'm supposed to adhere to it and discover yeah. it and learn more about it and be changed by it. And in its essence, that humility is the basis of all growth.
Right.
You think about kids. I had the conversation with Sadie yesterday. She's so offended when I correct her. She was interrupting, doing things. I'm watching it have ramifications in her 9-10-year-old friendships.
Uh-huh.
You know, all kids are doing it. She's not a bad kid. It's not a thing. But it's whether or not – and I go, hey, baby, let me tell you, when you keep interrupting this is happening here and here and here. Fine. Like, it's this
yeah. –
and I go, darling, I'm almost 40 years old. You know, it shouldn't hurt your feelings that I see something that you can't see at 9. You have a blind spot that all of us had at 9, and some of us still have at 39. And the path to – but you trust me to feed you, to drive you. You trust me to protect you at night. You trust me for all these things. If you can't trust me, though, to be able to point out things in your life
yeah.
that you can't see, that you don't know, and it's okay. She's offended that she doesn't know. And it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And I think that we're just embarrassed. We're just shamed as a culture. And so we overcompensate
uh-huh.
and we start acting like we know everything. And then we start calling all the people who have a perspective other than ours to be something horrible. We make monsters out of them so we don't have to listen to what the monster says.
Yeah. Sometimes I think like a comfort level that we have makes it harder because we're wired to elevate ourselves. I may have shared this before, but there's a comedian named Ken Davis, and he used to talk about the difference between cats and dogs.
Yeah.
And he'd say there's the difference between a humanist and somebody who believes in God, a theist. He says, I have a dog and I have a cat. I have a dog and the dog looks at me like, you feed me, you give me a roof over my head, you take care of me, you brush out my hair. You must be God. And my cat's like, you feed me, you brush out my hair, you give me a place to stay, you take care of me. I must be God. Right. It's like, so there's that thing of like, sometimes contentment can take us the other direction.
Yeah.
We're like, I deserve this.
Yeah.
I'm the maker of this. You know, there's even a scripture that talks about that they'll worship the creation. And we always think of that meaning like, oh, like Native Americans worship trees. No. Ourselves.
We are
a creation.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, like, so it's so easy for us to worship ourselves and not realize it, that we're elevating ourselves to this level.
Well, and that's the thing. We use the word worship and that turns us off to it. That's that, you know, that vernacular colorblindness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All worship means is, you know, who do you defer to? Where does your energy go? What is your time spent defending? What is your time spent improving? What mm-hmm. is your, you know, what do you get unintentionally angry about? And so, yeah. So when you're exactly right. When I'm the one, when you question my knowledge and that creates this knee jerk reaction within me, then it proves I am at least an object of my own worship, because I am the one I'm defending the most. And then, and it's inside. I think we all have that to some extent,
yeah.
But when we sell out to it, but I want it to change, you know, I want it to change. I had this thought the other day, you know, if you were out in the woods and you needed fire, you know, desperately, then that you could rub sticks together and do all the things that you see on Bear Grylls and all those shows. And if you've ever really tried to make a fire, and I did some camping programs, boy camping programs and things as a kid, and man, making fire without a match or a mm-hmm. lighter is a bigger deal than you might think, you know,
yeah.
to generate that kind of heat, with the airflow and all those things. So, and you were serious, weren't you?
No, I've never been able to do it.
Have you tried it?
With sticks?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's so you've done it?
When you're a kid, you try. You see yeah. all the things. Yeah, you experiment. And you could make something that will burn you, but
yeah.
you get hot enough. You can create friction enough that it hurts, but not enough to like
it. Well, I had corduroy pants as a kid, and I was pretty chubby. So I know about friction, but I'm...
But the easiest way to produce fire, when you can do all that energy,
yeah.
is for someone else to walk up who already has it. You know, they have a hot coal, or they have something that's already been on fire. Or they make a fire and then you go over and get a burning stick out of it and now suddenly you have fire. And I think about all of my talk and my theological thought and depth and all these things, and we're talking about lives being – is your life being changed? Is mm-hmm. Do you see your life being changed? And but I feel like sometimes I'm just rubbing sticks together trying to convince – and it's hot.
Yeah.
It's producing heat. And there's this, we're pointing out the friction and all those things, but really the way, if I want to prove to you that this fire is a real thing, would be that I had some,
yeah,
you know, that I could say to you guys,
and I didn't get it from myself.
Right. I could say, hey, here, look, this is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. And I think that if that, you know, if that thing in me is that my life is being changed, I can tell you. That for this is not just getting old. I've known lots of people who got older and they got more and more stubborn and more defensive of their viewpoint and all those things. I'm telling you that I really feel like Christ has done something and is doing something in me that causes me to rejoice in looking at my own ignorance, that is causing me to be open to change and to listen to viewpoints I've never had. And we haven't acknowledged it up to now. And, you know, when we lost Weston, you know, our friend, we had like 40, 50 young adults who used to be our students. And you were there, Johnny, yeah. at my house that Friday night after the visitation, before the funeral the next day. And, just lots of, it was cathartic and comforting, you know, in some ways to all be together.
Yeah.
And we were just eating pizza and eating snacks and hanging out on the deck or inside. Just there were just conversations going on everywhere, and people were reminiscing and thinking, and they were very sad, but there was a lot of funny stories to be told. And it was what community should be, you know. It was yeah. a moment to really be together. And lots of people walk up and they're introducing their spouses, or they're talking about their kids because we haven't seen them. People are living all over the place. And,
right.
You know, and you know, the thing that I always worry about is that I'm just hot air to them, and that as I'm trying to state that there's something new and different happening, but you're almost like the boy who cried Jesus. You know, they heard yeah. you their whole lives. You know, oh, it's the boy who cried Jesus again. Of course he cries Jesus. That's what he does. And you want to go, you know, I don't think that my words are enough. I mean, I can truthfully say that my understanding of the church, my understanding of what Jesus is doing in me and how he's rescuing me has changed. But I don't know if I have done a good job yet. I think the only way to do it is to show you the bad. I'm going to have to show you what was bad about me. And I got some who won't accept that.
They
can't. Oh, no, you're not that bad. You're not that bad. It's always that bad. You know, oh, no one's perfect, but and there's this vast eternal chasm between no one's perfect, but you're not that bad. And
yeah.
We say it so simply, but man, there is an absolute distance between there that we philosophically, theologically, we don't know what we're saying. That's a huge, huge deal. But to say, no, guys, listen, I acted like I wasn't that bad, and this is not about some traditional, conventional sin thing. I wasn't embezzling. I wasn't having an affair or all those things. I was worse. I thought myself to be good enough. I thought myself internally to be worthy of a little bit of worship, not God level, but a little bit. And it kept me from understanding new levels of the fullness of God's truth for me,
mm-hmm.
that he was patient with me through it and even it caused good things to happen, but it was just some hot sticks and it probably wasn't the fire that you needed to see. And I want to show it now, and I don't know how to do it, but
yeah.
I'm trying to say, no. Hey, there was a better way. There was a better way than all this work that's wearing you out. There was a better way than just do your devotions. There was a better way than just trust in Pastor John's theological knowledge of apologetics or whatever. There's a better way than pithy answers and alliterated sermons.
Yeah.
There's a better way than being passionate in worship. There's a better way than responsiveness. There's a better way than even taking a leadership role.
There's something about just believing that God loves you. And, you know, we were kind of raised to this thing of like, God loves you the way you are, and he loves you too much to let you stay that way. They've immediately had to follow it up with, now get working on this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that God won't change you, because he absolutely does. There's a thing of, I believe in sanctification. I believe that he transforms. But I also believe that, like, if you don't believe the first thing wholeheartedly, you're not going to get to that step. If you immediately follow it up with, like, yes, but. And I read this tweet the other day, and it really wrecked me. It was about the prodigal. And it was basically, we read the prodigal all the time. And we almost read it like the prodigal son changed his heart towards his father when he came back, and he was decided, I'm going to be a different son now. I'm going to do that's not true at all. In the story, he was just broke and broken. And he came home because he was devastated. And the father did not think, well, he'll have learned. You know, he just said, my son is home. And this idea that the prodigal had changed before he came back, we've already worked legalism into the mix.
Yeah.
That's not the story. The father was 100% okay with the thought of finally he's back. There's this thing of like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me. You know, I used to watch this, one of my favorite movies of all time, Say Anything. You ever seen Say Anything?
Oh, yeah.
So there's a story where she breaks up with him. Lloyd Dobler's the character, and he's this, like, you know, he's falls in love with this girl, and then she breaks up with him, and because she's pressured to by her dad. And then she takes him back after realizing, like, you know, this was a huge mistake. And he's like, she's like, I love you. And he says, are you saying that because you really love me or because you don't want to be alone? And then she starts to answer, and he goes, never mind, I don't care. And then he just holds her, you know? And I think there's something to that. Like, you know what? God will fix the other stuff. Like, if we'll just come, even if it's in our brokenness, even if it's because we're at our wits' end and we've tried everything else, every drug, everything, but we're at this place where we desperately need him and we're aware that he might take us back, you're starting to kind of glimpse what the real thing is.
I think you're right. And the legalist in me, it's that we do, you said it, we have the buts, we want to counterbalance the statement. And this has been the most revolutionary thing to me. If your counterbalance but statement here is, but are you saying that it doesn't matter what we do, then because we could just keep doing whatever we want, that's heresy about, you know, I would say, hey, there's a lot of validity absolutely to what you're saying. But until the kind of love of the Father that we are actually showing and actually talking about causes that question to be asked, then we haven't gotten to the radical fullness of it yet, because that's the same question Paul asked. Are you saying we can continue in sin that grace may abound? If our conversations lead us to a place where somebody on the other side feels a need to balance what I'm saying about God's radical love by asking that question, I feel that I'm in good company, because that's exactly the kind of grace that Paul talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning it made – he was a Pharisee, and he foresaw what his reader would ask.
Yeah.
He saw the counterbalance there. So it needs to be enough that you shift in your chair to go, that something's not – wait, you mean the father didn't care what he – the father absolutely cared what he did.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that Paul – I always think about Paul too, because he's used as an example in so many of our sermons, and of course he wrote half the New Testament. But to my way of thinking, he's one of the few educated people that God was ever able to use, and he had to radically – do something completely crazy to Paul. It's almost like I have to blind you and knock you off your horse to show you that you're already blind. Like I have to do something super drastic to this educated person.
Right.
Whereas the fisherman, he was just like, come follow me. They were like, cool. They dropped their nets.
Right.
Paul is like, wait a minute, because he overthinks, just like mm-hmm. we're talking about. He has to have the answers for anything. He thinks he already has the answers. Well, I know the answer. The answer is these are heretics, and they're an affront to the truth, and I got to imprison them and kill these people. Nope, you're wrong, and here, let me show you why. But he had to do something drastic. He blinds Paul. He knocks him off his horse. 3 days, he's blind. Then he causes him to be healed by a guy. Follow this guy. Go to this guy's house. And so there's all that journey of Paul that we kind of ignore, but it's like that's part of the deal when we put our education and our knowledge above just this thing of like, it's just, I don't know. It's so weird to think like now to say to somebody, well, it's just about love and it's God's love. And I used to be offended when people would say that. Like, it would bother me when people would say that, like they were minimizing the gospel to say that God loves everybody and he wants everybody. When the truth is, that's what it is. That's the miracle of it all. You know?
No, absolutely. And I think that the key to that is, if people say, are you saying that this is grace only, it's not a grace only message. It's a grace first message.
Right.
And that's the turn that matters. No, I never said it's all that. I never said that Jesus doesn't change you. I never said that Jesus disregards sin. Jesus died, you know, because of sin. God hates sin. And the reason is he wasn't hating just the act of the prodigal son spending his money on prostitutes and being used by all of his friends. It wasn't like the impersonal, you know, I just hate this inanimate thing that you're doing, this action. He hated the fact that his son was literally being lied to, abused, being exploited, and was away from his protection and relationship. So, yeah, he hates it. He hates it because of love for his son. So if we just make like our actions this, oh, God hates all these things outside of a grace being in, you know, where it should be in that equation, that love has to come first. If you have a message of Jesus where love does not come first, then you don't have a message of Jesus. I mean, it's then you hate what the Apostle John wrote and you hate what the Apostle Matthew wrote. Like, you don't believe what they're saying.
Yeah.
It's not what it is. You can quote it, you know, but it's not what they were saying, because it was offensively radical, and it still is. And so anyway, I know
when we call out fellow Christians, like we do sometimes, we say, oh, these fellow Christians, they get it wrong, or they blow it, or they're legalists or all that. Jesus did all that, and we do that, and it's Twitter's full of people who call out heretics. And the thing about Jesus is, yes, he flipped over the tables, he made a whip, he ran people out of the temple, and then a few days later, he died for those people.
Yeah.
So even the people who were completely in the wrong, he laid his life down for them. And I think that's the example. We got to figure out a way to be in disagreement with people and still lay down our life for them. That's the hard part.
Wow. That's good. And if you see yourself in that story, everybody was wrong but Jesus.
Yeah.
His disciples, the Pharisees, everybody is a villain in the story but Jesus, and he died for all of them. And so, yeah, it's easy. You can be the godless. You can be the absolute God-fearing legalist on all of these things. Everyone's equal in need of a savior. So, wow. Hey, that was good. We're a little out of time today, Johnny. It actually has been 2 days, so we shouldn't be held accountable.
It's 2 days worth of – by the way, this is off subject, but kind of on subject. I wanted to say this when you were talking about the campfire thing. Why was there never a series of campfire grills called Bear Grills? Why did he not monetize that? Like they could be almost shaped like a little bear. Like an outdoor camping grill.
Dude, we – You know what?
Guys, get in touch with us. Bear Grylls, if you're listening, please. There's a chance he's a listener. I don't know what he's doing now.
There's a good chance.
His window is probably passed, right?
Actually, no. He's on like NBC or something. He's still doing that celebrity thing.
But wasn't it kind of discovered that like he was staying in hotels and stuff and none of that was real?
No.
Yeah, he was one of those guys.
No, John.
I'm going to research it and come back.
Gosh, you were going to be that guy.
He was, I'm saying like.
Don't trust your own knowledge, bro.
I'm telling you, I think there was stuff going on. Like, he wasn't really.
No, I think the deal was that there were times that what you saw in 3 days happened over the course of 2 weeks. And so in between, maybe.
I don't mean
like.
Did
you want him to live out there 2 weeks but only show 3 days of it? Give him a break, bro.
I think he was at a Marriott in between those. He looked well-rested a lot of those times. Too well-rested. I have circles under my eyes, and I sleep in a bed.
Maybe he sat in a Marriott bed and still ate slugs and stuff.
Like, yeah, like, that's a good mix.
He just didn't take a shower.
He didn't do the continental breakfast. He's like, no, I'm good. I'll just squeeze the water from this elephant dung. BearGrylls.com.
Not a sponsor. Hey, guys, listen, thanks for listening. And, man, We've come a long way. It's not quite a year. It'll be a year in September, Johnny.
Beautiful.
We'll be doing this podcast. So we're looking forward. That'll be season two when we start. So season one's still going strong, bro. And we're going to have an exciting – Johnny and I were talking off of the recording this morning of some exciting changes that are coming to the look of the Talk About That podcast.
The look and feel.
For coming. So stay tuned for that. Share it with a friend if it made a difference for you. If it didn't, share it anyway. We don't. It's okay. Yeah. Don't discriminate against us just because we didn't make a difference in your life. But go ahead and tell your friends about it. But thanks for subscribing. We'll see you next time on
Talk About That.
Hi, I'm Zach.
And I'm Randy.
And we're from Salty Saints Podcast. We're a theology and apologetics podcast.
To find out more, subscribe at lifeaudio.com.